Next item, public hearing pertaining to culling of crabs. Mr. O'Reilly.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
Last month, we presented this information to you, and the commission elected to defer the public hearing and to have us re-advertise. Okay. A little help from our friends here. To re-advertise, mainly Dr. Lipschitz from VIMS requested some additional time to prepare his report, also to have a literature review done. And at one point, I think Dr. Lipschitz also was going to have some peer advice on the information. The information that we're going to present today does take into account the two items that you see up on the screen. The first is the sponge crab issue, and the second is a broadening of the sanctuary into the coastal area. This particular figure was compiled in 2002 by Dr. Lipschitz in advance of the last and most recent broadening of the sanctuary area, and you can see that in the hatched area. So at this time, it was Dr. Lipschitz's opinion, at least, that there was a 70% protection of sponge crabs with the increase of the sanctuary to 927 square miles. So that last increase again was in 2002. I think that's an important component to consider, because part of today's information is to look at removing the ban on taking dark-colored sponge crabs. So it's very important to realize that roughly what you're looking at is the 30% of the sponge crabs that don't currently have protection by way of the June 1st to September 15th sanctuary. You saw this slide last month, and here's where the delineation starts in between these two stages of the sponge crabs. The maturity is running this way downwards and culminating to where in here the eggs are really larvae with eye spots, and it's from here to here, which is currently considered brown through black colored sponges. Those are prohibited except for a tolerance of 10 per bushel or 35 per barrel. This is a lot of information, but again, this is the commission's activity since 1994. Many different items. One was that back in 1994, a winter sanctuary was established. Also, there was a small arm of the sanctuary established on the eastern shore. When you come through and come through the list, and since I presented this before, I'm not going to go over it line item, but also in 2002, along with measures to satisfy the bi-state agreement for a 15% reduction in the exploitation rate on blue crab, this blue crab sanctuary was broadened by 272 square miles, and that's what you saw in the first figure. With the lighting, that may show up or not, but you see the idea of managing the spawning potential. First of all, that's a very difficult task. The reason it's difficult is there is a significant relationship between the size of the spawning stock and the amount of recruits that result, but it is a fairly weak relationship. In most cases, you can find that larger amounts of spawning females will produce better recruits or a larger number of recruits, but not all the time. I can't remember exactly offhand, but I think that probably 26% of the time, whatever the variation is in the spawning stock, that's what it'll be in the recruits. So when you manage the spawning potential, you're managing around that relationship. You're also managing over the facts of the environment. When crabs spawn and the larvae are evicted out into the sea. They're there for anywhere from 30 to 45 days. They're entrained back in as megalope, post-larval, and then there's an additional 30 days or more before you have any settlement going on where they have definitely started to become better able to fend off predation and other factors. We do have the abilities today, at least, to probe some of these questions, and it is related to what can you do for the spawning stock or spawning potential. You can expand sanctuaries, as we did. That's been done. You can have coal rings, which we have done on different occasions. A coal ring really is another way to increase the minimum size limit. In the case of the coal ring, it lets smaller crabs escape, and in a way, you are increasing the size limit to some extent. If you increase the size limit, you are boosting the spawning potential. In 1996, that's when the dark-colored sponge crab ban took place. I think what you have to consider, in 1996, we had had, I think, three or four events from the VIMS fall trawl survey indicating that spawning stock had fallen off since 1992 and was holding at very low levels. In 1996, just like in other years, the commission wanted to try and boost or augment the spawning potential. That's how the ban on dark-colored sponge crabs came about. In addition, in 1996, it was only 1 year removed from the first analytical stock assessment that was done in 1995 by the Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee. And the stock assessment benefits are that it started to give some information on what the exploitation rate was for blue crab and some indication of what abundances might be a good abundance versus a poor abundance. The control rule example that you saw last month, that's what the initial stock assessment started. However, it's only been with the 2005 assessment that we really have a control rule that you can look at and know about abundance and know about exploitation rates and know where you stand with the current year's fishery. In 1999 and 2000, there were further measures, but the important one there was another addition to the spawning sanctuary, and this was an additional 435 square miles. And then finally in 2002, as you saw, another 272 square miles. So in effect, the industry could have come to the Crab Management Advisory Committee or to the commission years ago, before they did in 2005, and questioned the need for the dark sponge crab ban. Because after all, the spawning sanctuary being increased twice, 2000 and 2002, effectively protect 70% of the spawning potential. However, there are other factors to consider. One is the spawning potential overall. This is a depiction of recent information from the Baywide Crab Dredge Survey, which was just released yesterday. And one component is the female crabs that are 60 millimeters and greater, so 2.4 inches and greater. Those that will spawn in that time period, in that year. And you can see 2007, slightly better than 2006. This is an average line, the red line. These are error bars. So with the error bars, it's pretty close to what average is. Nonetheless, if you go across the time series, you do see that it's in the bottom third in terms of importance or number of potential spawners. So one thing to consider about the lifting of the ban on dark-colored sponge crabs is certainly the state of the female crabs. And this is a contrast to look at in terms of the VIMS data. It's a little different than the dredge survey data. However, as Dr. Lipschitz has told you before, these data are taken right on the spawning grounds. I believe it's July through November. And you can see that really, if I can find my pointer again, there it is. This looks like 1992 forward, low abundance of the spawning females or the spawning potential, consistently low. Dr. Lipschitz is going to present the 2006 data to the Crab Management Advisory Committee coming up on the 30th, I believe, of this month. There are expectations that it is not going to rise very much, if at all. We don't know, but we don't expect that. So one thing that's different between 1996 and now is that even though there is the potential protection afforded by the increases in the sanctuary, perhaps protecting as much as 70% of the spawning potential or the spawning stock, there still is a condition of low spawning potential, and it's remained there. So for that reason, it becomes even more important to consider everything the Commission does in terms of whether it will aid or whether it will not aid the spawning stock. This is also in the recently released Baywide Dredge Survey Report, which is conducted by VIMS and the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. These are age zero crabs. It's a little bit of a misnomer because they aren't age, but age zero refers to the size. So these are blue crabs that are up to 60 millimeters in carapace width. They are the recruits, essentially. And you can see in 2007 that it's a very low amount of recruits. In fact, it's second lowest in this time series since 1990 when the Baywide Dredge Survey started. The forecast from that information is that it's expected with the low recruits, but somewhat better females, mature females, spawning potential females, and also the males that harvest in 2007 will be roughly equivalent to 2006.
I've got to ask this question.
Yes.
2007 and 1992 are about the same. What happened between 92 and 93?
These are the zeros. So what happens here is strictly the relationship I talked about, that you don't always have a one-to-one correspondence and nowhere near it between the amount of spawners and the amount of recruits.
Okay.
One thing interesting, though, is 1991, and I'm going to talk about this in a second. 1991 was a fairly good year for recruits. And as you can see, it's up here somewhere, I think 1991 was also a good harvest year. So one thing to consider here as a later slide will be when I show the exploitation rate, what you're going to see is the exploitation rate is very similar, about the same as it was in 1991. However, the harvests are much different because the recent harvests are down here below, well below average, which is 75 million pounds for the bay. 1991 is well above that. And so the idea is that if the abundance were to be greater, you can still extract more crabs in the harvest and keep the exploitation rate the same. I mean, that's the way it's established. Let me make sure I didn't miss one. There we are. So here's the exploitation rate. And again, here's 1991. Exploitation rate is 35% per year. 2005, 37% per year. Here's the target. Where you'd like to be close to the target, you definitely don't want to be over this threshold, which we went over last month as part of the control rule. So to be here tells you there's a low harvest, there's a low exploitation rate, the fishery's not operating near where it was in 1991. This is another piece of information. There are some contrasts. Not only is there a contrast between the spawning potential depicted by the Baywide Dredge Survey, which is baywide compared to the VIMS spawning ground survey, there's also information from the Baywide Dredge Survey on the females that are south of Windmill Point. So when the survey is done, they divide it into sectors, three sectors. In this sector, in 2004 and 2005, female abundance was up. It did not show up, as you saw in the slide on the spawning ground, so it didn't translate into greater spawning potential. There is a problem in Virginia, and the biggest problem is that we have a lot of female crabs in Virginia compared to Maryland. most of our fisheries do operate off female crabs. The pot fishery is about 86% of our total, and that is anywhere from 65 to 70% in 1 year of females. The winter dredge fishery, albeit small in recent years in terms of harvest, is 95% female. Probably the only one that has closer to a one-to-one male-to-female ratio is the smaller fishery on the peelers. And again, there's a fishery that doubled from 1994 to about 1999 and since has returned to 1994 levels. So the exploitation rates you see here, the yellow is female exploitation and the blue is the males, and you can see that consistently since about 1994, it looks like, the female exploitation rate has been much higher. Just another piece of information that this issue today does involve some care in terms of future direction with protecting the spawning stock. This shows the sanctuary that exists here. This is the 1942 sanctuary. There was a 1994 addition over here. And by 2000 and 2002, this broadened the sanctuary to give the coverage that was mentioned of 70% of the sponge crabs. This does a better job showing you the current proposal to augment the sanctuary and add on out to the 3 mile limit line and down to the North Carolina-Virginia line. That's what's proposed today. And could I have the lights, please? Thank you. The staff recommendation is tentative only because we're not certain how much extra work Dr. Lipschitz has been able to accomplish, given that it's been a month. This issue has been around for 2 years, but nonetheless, it's one that at least staff at VMRC thinks has to be done in a fairly comprehensive manner, and we know of the experiments that Dr. Lipschitz has done to date, or at least some of them, do show a high mortality of the sponges and, in fact, of the crabs themselves. The one that we're familiar with is mainly an August experiment where 80% of control crabs suffered mortality by 15 or 16 days and 90% of the crabs that were in the experiment. However, in terms of eliminating the current ban on sponge crabs, should there not be a comprehensive evaluation, staff at least thinks that perhaps the commission might want to consider alternatives, even a stepwise fashion here. Have to recall that 70% of the sponge crabs are protected by the sanctuaries. The Crab Management Advisory Committee and staff wish to add on that coastal or ocean sanctuary. That'll afford some more protection. At the same time, I think everyone is aware that by the time you get to the midsummer, whether it's July 15th you want to consider forward, temperatures are very hot. Staff here has not done an exhaustive literature review, but we're very aware that temperature is a driver in this process. Just the effects of crabs being in the pot is stressful enough. The fact that it's very warm water, then they're pulled up, they're handled, and they're discarded, all of that together would suggest to anyone that the warmer temperatures are not going to be a benefit to sponges, let alone the crabs themselves. We do agree with that. The concerns we have are that the experiments to date that we know of were limited in scope to the Elizabeth River and also limited in time, perhaps July and part of August. There is a minor peak of spawning that does occur in June, and we don't know yet. We'll wait for Dr. Lipschitz, but we don't know whether the information from the midsummer to late summer experiments translate into the earlier summer. So we have to wait on that. Compared to the evaluations message on the sanctuary, we would like to see that adopted as we do the, think the Crab Management Advisory Committee supports that. That's not a major harvest area right at this time. There were only one or two harvesters in the last few years. However, if there is a lifting of the ban on sponge crabs, it would not be prudent to have harvesters go into that area. I have one handout. This is the addition to the crab sanctuary. If you could look at that first before we go back to the sponge crab regulation. And if you turn to page 3, you'll see through the underlined text that really the addition is concerning this area out to the 3-mile limit line and down to the border of North Carolina and Virginia. So that does encompass this, the addition to the sanctuary. Secondly, at the bottom of page 3, you'll see that the phrase starts with, except that recreational crabbing shall be lawful within this coastal area. And that is complementary to the original sanctuary, the 1942 sanctuary area here, where the code had established that recreational crabbing was lawful. Concerning the sponge crab regulation, which is in your packet at the very back, that hasn't changed since last month. And if you just go through the pages, starting with page 1, what the amendments do are to really eliminate the ban completely. And right now, the way things are established, the ban is not time certain. It's just during the season. And after you hear Dr. Lipschitz, I think it would be appropriate to see if alternatives in the timing of lifting the ban are necessary. Mm-hmm. And that's all staff has.
Any questions, Rob? Dr. McConaughey.
I just have a comment. And on that 70%, I think that may be a little bit high in the sanctuary, because we know the females, after they spawn, they move in and out of the sanctuary, so that they could be producing a second sponge outside of that sanctuary and then moving back out to spawn. They move both ways. They move both towards the tributaries as well as offshore. And in fact, in a tagging study, some of them end up in Beaufort, North Carolina. So they're moving that way as well. So just keep in mind that 70% may be high in terms of what we're protecting by the sanctuary.
Yes, sir.
All right. I think it would be prudent now to hear from Dr. Lipschitz.
Yes.
Ron? Good afternoon, sir.
Sure. We'll do a trade, all right?
It's happened before.
Only scientists. Cruel joke to play, wasn't it, Ron?
Sorry. Well, first of all, thanks, Commissioner Bowman, and commissioners as well. I just wanted to make you aware, Rob gave you the highlights of this, but this is the press release, and there's been a joint press release by Maryland DNR as well as VIMS. The two press releases do differ a little bit in what they say, but ultimately the bottom line is the same, and that is that the Blue Crab Winter Dredge Survey shows, we choose to say steady, but low adult abundance and low densities of young of the year crabs. And I'll emphasize, Maryland DNR says stable. We don't like the word stable because that implies or suggests resilience to disturbance. And it's at a low level of abundance. It has been steady at that low level, but we're not confident that it's resilient to major disturbances. So you see the difference between DNR and ours. That's why. So I won't go over this. Rob basically gave you the bottom line on this. What I will do is give you the summary. What I had promised you is that we would do a comprehensive review of trap-related mortality, handling trap-related mortality, and we chose to do this broadly across all crustaceans, whatever we could find. And I had a postdoc that worked with us, Kate Mansfield, as well as John Honig. So this reflects the work that all three of us have done. And the reason we chose most all crustaceans is because there is little information on the blue crab per se, but we have found some information. So the problem, as you're aware, current regulations prohibit the taking of brown and black sponge female crabs. And there was a suggestion, certainly the crabbers and processors have told us that they think that there's very high mortality. And so that's a loss both to the resource, since those crabs are not contributing to spawning, and also to the fishery. And so it doesn't make sense to continue something if it's a major loss to both. What we did then is we conducted a literature review, 38-plus papers. We're still accumulating more, but we think we have the bulk of the papers. These are all peer-reviewed papers, as well as 13-plus technical gray literature reports. And these are all federal, as well as some federal and local regulatory documents. I will emphasize we're still continuing this, but we think that we have a very good sense of what happens. Now, to tell you what the various processes that are going to affect blue crab survival from what we found in the literature, the first one is exposure stress, simply exposing them to the heat in the summertime. Another one is in-trap agonism. They're aggressive. The crab, blue crab, is an aggressive creature, and so in the traps you're going to have some sort of aggressive interactions and behavior. Third, trap and handling stress, simply being in the traps, and particularly during the summertime, there's some physiological stress associated with that. Trap time, the amount of time they spend in the traps. And then there's a delayed mortality, which we typically see in the blue crab. That is that you don't see the mortality right off. You don't see it the day after the crab has been in the trap. This has happened in the laboratory as well, that quite often you won't see the crabs die until about a week or two later. They've been stressed, but they actually survive over that time, and then all of a sudden we'll see a high mortality event. This has happened quite often to us in when we've run laboratory experiments over the last 20 years, and it just... The crab can survive for a while, but then it'll die. So we were looking again at other crustaceans. I'm not going to go through each one of these. What I'm going to do is summarize. The first one is this heat stress. This is a very common a stress that we've seen in all species, particularly the subtropical species like Caribbean spiny lobster, blue crab, and others that are exposed to thermal stress in particular. So you can have air exposure that causes acidosis, behavioral effects, that reduces activity levels, reduces their ability to avoid predators and such. There are delayed effects, and these delayed effects in mortality are seen even after fairly short periods of exposure, 0.5 to 5 hours, half hour to 5 hours. It's been seen in spiny, slipper, rock lobster, stone crabs, and we've seen some in blue crabs. Egg loss across the board. You have a loss of egg viability. The sponges are reduced in viability as well as size. We've got reduced growth rates. And for the blue crab, there's some evidence of trapped females damaging their own sponge when the conditions are thermally stressful, that is hot temperatures. In-trap agonism, another common process that affects blue crab survival and growth. Injuries are common among most trap species. So you've got the loss of limbs, greater risk of predation, and so on. In the blue crabs, it's been documented that you have appendage loss results in a reduced ability to feed. I mean, that makes sense. Decreased walking speeds, avoidance of predators, increased stationary periods, they're just basically inactive, and reduced ability to maintain upstream swimming progress. Basically, it says is reducing their ability to migrate, to move. So their general activity is reduced as a result of being held in a trap, and the agonistic. Agonistic is simply aggressive interactions that you have ongoing when you have two or more crabs. Trap and handling stress. Across the board, these are the sorts of effects you see, and if you focus on the yellow, you'll see that there's weight loss, there are injuries, again, the delayed effects of mortality, 25% to 77% mortality among lobsters. The Hawaiian lobsters are a spiny lobster, similar to the Caribbean spiny lobster and the blue crab, both which co-occur. When they're handled on deck, increased mortality when you handle soft shells. Sort of an interesting scenario, the fourth one down, dropping snow crabs from 8+ feet. So that's probably not very relevant to what we're doing, but it causes injury in snow crabs. We want it to be comprehensive. And in the blue crab, greater sponge damage occurs, up to 50% of the sponge from traps versus hand catching and hand capture. And here's the information. This is these are the results of a 2006 study conducted in North Carolina with blue crabs. And basically what they did, they either caught blue crabs in traps or they dip netted them. And so they had these two treatments. The two on the right are trap caught, and the one set of bars on the left is dip netted. On the very bottom, which you can't see on each one, is the size. And so if you look here, so this is the dip netted group of crabs, and then these are the trap caught. Across the bottom is size. These are small crabs, about three to four inches actually, and then increasing in size, so across the board. And what this response is the percent of the sponge that is still viable, that remains. And the bottom line, there are really two bottom lines for this. So what they did is they either dip netted or trap caught them and then held them in minnow traps for a prolonged period. And there are a couple of really interesting observations. One, for us, is that the dip netted ones suffered relatively little loss of the sponge. So roughly 95% of the sponge was still intact and viable. In the trap-caught animals, it ranged from 20 to 55% of the sponge was lost. This is after being in the trap for a day and being caught. And these were conducted in June and July, whereas these were conducted in July and August. So it looks like you have some additional stress. Now, again, we have to repeat this, but there's additional stress in the summertime. So you've got a major loss in the viability of the sponges. This is the only study we found so far, and it was, as I said, just recently published. The other interesting thing that came from their study is they actually followed those crabs in the traps, and they found and estimate that their females are producing, on average, each female in a single spawning season is producing, on average, 8 sponges. It's a brand new finding. We always thought it was about 2 or 3. And they are estimating 8. They were getting as many as 7 from an individual female there, and they didn't hold it through the whole spawning season. So what that says is that if you translate that to the Chesapeake, it suggests that the crabs here are going to be producing 4 to 5 sponges. If you extrapolate their information and account for the change, the differences in temperature. So that's something really important to note. That's also backed up by a study that was done in Florida by Tuck Hines of the Smithsonian, who showed the same thing, that basically 7 to 8 sponges in a single spawning season, when you have that protracted spawning season. The implications of this are that those newly matured females are extremely important, they're extremely fecund, and if you leave them alone, they can produce a fairly large number of sponges and then contribute to the reproductive output, as opposed to increasing that mortality dramatically in each of the sponges and in the females. Okay. So that was a very important finding, I think, for us. Trap time. The increased trap time results in increased mortality for many species. Even in Dungeness crab, a cooler temperature, cooler water species, up to 41% increase in mortality. And it's usually higher for the tropical species. For the blue crab, few data exist. We have the one set of studies, but we're going to replicate that. Here's, just to remind you, this is the data that we had. And this is the third in a set of studies, a set of experiments that we conducted. And we took as an estimate of the mortality per day what happened over the first day. There's a problem in that we were holding them in traps. Even though we were holding them only a couple to a trap and feeding them daily, there's still that trap-induced mortality, which at that point we thought was negligible because we thought most of the stress was going to be on deck, that point, that half hour to however many hours they're held on deck, or minutes even. And this was the surprising finding. So we were estimating from that first set of data points it's about 13% mortality per day when it's hot, during July, August. So that's what we're about to do now is we're going, now that we've received the funding to continue the dredge survey and our summertime nursery habitat survey, we're able finally to dedicate some more personnel to actually redoing this study. We're going to do it in May, and then at least a couple more times in the summer, and then we're going to do it with males as well as females and do it similar to the way we did it here, but also in incorporating some of what North Carolina found. So we're going to redo this and get a pretty thorough seasonal view of trap-related mortality. We also have enlisted Harriet Perry. Some of you may know Harriet. She is with the University of Southern Mississippi, and she is affiliated with the Gulf Coast crab fisheries, and she's going to conduct the same sort of study down there. There's a concern now among all the states that this trap-related mortality is one of these very subtle sources of mortality that we haven't realized over the long term, and so we've got a more comprehensive study going. Finally, the delayed mortality. Air exposure, we see delayed mortality up to 42% of spiny lobsters die from less than 5 hours of exposure. We've seen some similar things with crabs. Behavioral effects for lobsters, that may be more important. Egg loss and decrease in larval production across a range of species. Changes in growth rates, usually a reduction in growth rates. And then with the blue crab, the inference is that trap or handling related injuries result in reduced walking speeds, foraging success, these other sorts of secondary effects. So here's the bottom line from this. From our review of all crustaceans, there is little to indicate that that trap-related stress and handling and so are trivial. They appear to be significant. They can cause upwards of 50, 60% mortality or higher. They can cause a reduction in the egg production of 50% or more. They reduce growth, and thus they also decrease fishery yield. So we're losing a fairly substantial biomass, we think, not only for the resource of the spawning stock, but also from the fishery. So limits on the handling and the capture of females in the sanctuary, we think, is expected to enhance female survival and reproductive output. And now a more comprehensive evaluation of capture-related stress is necessary, and as I mentioned, it's ongoing. Related to what Rob mentioned, is we would agree, first of all, with the recommendation about expansion of the sanctuary, and we would agree further that it may be wise to simply limit the prohibition or elimination of the prohibition during the hot months, that is July and August and maybe into September. So we're not convinced yet that there is this level of mortality in June yet, so it may be wise to leave the prohibition in effect. And I would leave that to a negotiation or discussion with staff. But we are in general agreement with what Rob recommended.
Any questions for Dr. Lifshitz? Dr. McConaughey.
I'm glad you went back and kind of looked at some of the physical factors, because when I started looking at your study there, I mean, you obviously have a stress mortality in those pots. Mm-hmm. But it could be temperature. It could be low DO that we know was in the area, aggressive interactions, as you mentioned, and it was done in an industrial river. And so I think trying to take those from August and move them and apply that to the whole part of the bay is questionable, because you can't really point out that you don't know which one of those factors actually caused the stress or caused the mortality. Most likely it was a combination of all of them. put together. So I think we need to be very careful about looking at that and expanding that whole area. The egg stuff that you showed from North Carolina, the females that they used in the minnow traps were only the ones they dip netted. And the trap ones, they just looked at the sponge and
right.
saw, but they just looked at the size and looked at it.
Right.
And it's been known since the 1960s that when you put a female blue crab in its any kind of confined space, they start to pull their eggs off. That's why the eggs are always taken off if you're going to try and hatch them out. So, you know, they're seeing it. They didn't actually count eggs, so they don't really know how much damage was there. So stressing that it was 50% or more, I think, is stretching it a little bit. I spent about an hour and a half on the phone with the authors of that paper. And the fact that they kept their crabs that they dip netted in those minnow buckets for 18 weeks and had minimal mortality until the temperature got warm suggests that temperatures is what's kind of driving some of what we're seeing.
Okay, so if I could address, I would agree
yeah.
that temperature, certainly the physical factors are going to be important. As far as whether or not this is broadly applicable, I would say there are two conclusions. One is that it is broadly applicable in the sense that we observe it in all crustaceans. So what the actual degree of the mortality is, I think, is the one that we don't have high precision on that. But that trap handling or some trap-related stress induces mortality and reduced growth, I think you can't argue with the comprehensive review. The degree to which it affects it, yes, I think that's something we need to get better data on. It wasn't a low DO issue only because we measured DO and it wasn't low there and it was in the shallow areas. So as far as when we conducted the study, anyway, it wasn't a low DO issue. But certainly it was there was agonistic behavior and there were certainly the warmer temperatures. So I'm not sure exactly what point you're trying to make in this regard other than the precision with which we're estimating this. Yes, we don't have enough data on that.
Well, I was just pointing out that, yes, it happens in other crustaceans, but the situations are often different. A lot of those lobster studies where they were on deck for hours cause mm-hmm. physiological problems, but they also recover after that.
They ended up, a very large fraction ended up dying. I mean, that's my own experience. I worked on lobster for 20 years, and we saw the same thing. So that was the point of this, that there's that delayed mortality that happens. I think, in my view, the conclusion is pretty clear that across the board, you're going to have some trap-related mortality or reduction in growth. And to what degree it does it is the real question. Whether or not it, to what degree it happens in blue crab is going to be greater in the summertime, but it's definitely happening. To what degree, again, is the real issue. We need to see or get a better estimate of that.
Well, I was just, yeah, there's going to be some mortality. The question is how much, and is there a difference between the mortality versus the benefit of these females spawning one more time?
Well, I think if you look at it in terms of a management sense, the idea of releasing the crabs at a time when they're suffering higher mortality, and then they're not contributing, the larger fraction is not contributing to spawning stock and is also being lost from the fishery, I think that would argue that that's an avenue we want to avoid. We want to move towards having something, a regulation that is going to be effective. So we know the sanctuary itself is leaving the crabs alone, and we know that's going to work. We want to preempt the fishery into the seaside. And then secondly, to more thoroughly evaluate what is happening inside of the bay. I think that's the real lesson I'm getting from this, is that we need to look at this much more thoroughly than we did before. We sort of ignored it, and we need to just keep looking at it. So in that sense, I certainly agree that we need to get a better handle on this.
Well, as I see it at this juncture, we have two very, very wise and well-educated crab specialist, quite honestly. And I think before we proceed further, as far as a public hearing is concerned, I think it'd be nice at this juncture, I've heard what you, Ron, if we could come up with some type of collective suggestion. I mean, I think from what I'm hearing as a layman, and I'll be quite honest with that, is that the sanctuary seems to be a good idea. I don't think there's any, not a whole lot of, you know, divergence from that being. Where we are, though, is what do we do with the sponge crab law that we presently have? I think from what I'm hearing from Rom is that where we initially thought that maybe an outright elimination of the ban may have been possible, now, based on your evaluation, it probably requires a little bit more study for an outright, but at the same time, possibility of having it associated with water temperature, maybe. But I haven't heard what you think of that, Doctor.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a compromise might be that we could keep the ban in place until, say, July 15th. That allows most of these females, since they do produce multiple broods, to spawn once, get some protection. We are going to lose some, but probably not as many as when it gets warm. And by the time you get into, you know, the really warm waters of late July and into August, there's probably increased mortality.
My next question is, how far do we then go from July 15th? Rom had mentioned, you know, August or September, but from a specifics perspective, what's the consensus? Where do we go? How far do we go?
Most in most years, reproduction is done by about the 15th of September. I've got a student who's been looking at that for the last 6 years, and after about mid-September, she can't find very many oviparous females. Last year was an anomaly. It started in May, which was a month early, and went into October. But 5 out of 6 years, it's over by the middle of September. So we could put that, you know, July 15th to September.
Rob, I'd like to hear if you have anything, and then I'm going to open up the public hearing.
Well, a couple of things. And Jack and I talked about one.
Is he behind you?
Yes.
Oh, I hadn't seen
him. All right behind me.
He's done a good job behind
me. I haven't seen him all afternoon.
There's what's been troubling me off and on going through this couple of months of evaluations is the idea of the de facto closed area, because that's something that industry has told us time and time again, and it's really been more than just an idea. I mean, if the sponge crabs are brown through black and are proliferating in an area, then the crabber doesn't want to go through the culling attempts and will be elsewhere. So there must be more to it than that. And I think what's more to it than that is the patchy distribution of crabs, period. If they're patchy, the sponges are patchy. And I think that one thing that Dr. Lipschitz had in his experiment in 2005 was different stages, early maturing versus late maturing sponges. So I don't know how much the real de facto closed areas are out there right now. So it seems to me we're managing outside the sanctuary. And the one thing that Jack and I talked about, if they are harvesting late maturing sponge crabs and throwing them back, despite the fact that the experiment that Dr. Lipschitz had results for on mortality of the female crab, not just sponge, but that there is mortality of the female crab, at the same time, with multiple clutches being formed, if that sponge crab goes back, it may be the sponge that doesn't survive, but in a lot of cases, the crab will. So I think there is conservation, but the only question I would have for either or both Dr. McConaughey and Dr. Lipschitz, and I think Dr. McConaughey was starting to talk about it, is the timing of crabs to get in the sanctuary to spawn. So, for example, there's a minor peak of spawning, say, in early June, a major peak let's say, in early August. I'm just saying that. And so the regulation could probably take that into account. And certainly since the major peak is in the early August time period, that's where you'd have some safety in numbers in terms of spawning. And that's where I think everyone is saying you're already into hot weather by the time you hit mid-July. The only other thing I would add is if crabs aren't ovigerous past mid-September, then there's really no reason to have start and stop dates with this, right, because it would phase out by itself as it has before.
Okay.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. I was going to do that. Now, ask for questions for Rob or...
Well, I have several questions, if you don't
absolutely
mind, for Rom, actually. Rom, you mentioned when you were speaking that you were considering a new study, I guess on the same issue, some more field trials, and you mentioned that you would cover the months of May and also some observations during summer. Is that something you have scheduled for this year, tentatively?
Yes.
Okay, so
starting that this May, and that the collaborative study with Harriet will also occur in this May.
At what point do you think you could report back to the commission on that?
Well, we'll have the results of the May study by the end of May. And then as we get them, I mean, it's straightforward because it's basically assessing survival of the crabs out in the field, and we get that directly. So we'll be monitoring them for about 2 weeks total. So by the end of May, we should have the results.
Okay. The other two questions were the North Carolina information you presented showed some differential results for early versus late summer. The late summer results showing higher mortality, and were those differences significant?
Well, I think you have to take that with a grain of salt because there was nothing. It was done in two different locations, two different times, so okay, it's possible that it was a location effect, but it's consistent with the temperature effect.
Those were
different, but you have to be careful.
That wasn't the only difference then. But what about the original study you did? What was the timing of that study? Was that August?
Yes, we did that in late July and August.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions for Dr. Lipschitz?
Just a comment on that North Carolina study. One of the things they did see is as the season went by and the number of broods increased that they'd produced, the number of eggs went down. So they peak in that first brood or two, and then the number of eggs start to fall off. And we see similar types of things here.
Actually, one other interesting thing I will add to that is that the small females and large females produce in total about the same number of eggs through the season because the smaller females were producing more clutches, but smaller ones, the larger ones, were producing fewer but larger clutches. The small ones producing smaller, more frequent clutches.
Interesting. So.
And July 15th might be a good start date.
Got it right here.
It's kind of a compromise.
Right there. I'd like to open up the public hearing. Mr. Nixon, hit your hand up. Come on up, Pete. Good afternoon to you.
Maybe not for me. I think this is turned into just a big time thief for some of us, this particular issue. I'm Peter Nixon. I'm president of Lower Chesapeake Watermen's Association. I'm on the board of directors of the Virginia Seafood Council, and I've been a member of the Blue Crab Advisory Committee for so long, I don't even know how long it is. 18 years. I've been here through three commissioners. I don't know how many associate commissioners. And I have been on that committee when every one of those regulations and laws was put up there except for the 1942 sanctuary. That was a little bit before my time. If, as a member of that committee, if we had had all the information before us at the time that we voted yay on this black sponge regulation, we would have probably not passed it. We would have felt that it was a waste of time for the amount of headache that it has been for most of us that work the water on a daily basis. The original regulation was based on theory and assumption that as the yolk expired on the crabs and the larvae grew bigger, that we might be doing something proactive in letting these crabs go. But as some of us that have participated in this fishery for a long time already knew, the dead loss that you incur with female crabs from this time of the year right on through till the early part of September is fairly high anyway. Whenever they're pregnant, it's even worse, or with a sponge on. Now, to some of us, when it appears that there's been no appreciable benefit from this regulation, which has been on the books now for 10 or 11 years, you saw in the data that was given you from the time that we implemented this regulation, it's been a downhill run. Before that, it was better. There's something else that we've not addressed in this fishery that's causing that problem, and it's not black sponge crabs. If you can originally propose a regulation based on theory and assumption with no facts, how in the world do you expect someone to come up with facts and scientific data before you take it off? If you didn't have it to begin with, how do you have something to prove in order to take it off? I've heard a lot of discussion about dead loss here and what's going to die in a pot, what's going to die after handling it. Yesterday on Monday, after a two-day soak, female crabs that are pregnant but not with a sponge on, we had as much as 25% dead loss yesterday, 4 or 5 hours after the crabs came out of water. We retail all our crabs, and we have to go through them, and we can only sell what's alive. That's how much loss I had yesterday. What was the water temperature yesterday? 50, 51, 52? And that's simply because they spent an extra day in the pot. Today's loss won't be that great. With this 8-hour day, you have exacerbated that situation. It looked like on paper when we had to pass that in order to comply with the Bi-State Blue Crab Advisory Committee proposal of 15%, that it would do something realistic. Realistically, what it did was it had crabbers increase their gear and let most of it soak for 2 or 3 days in order to guarantee themselves an appreciable catch in an 8-hour day if for some reason they weren't able to fish the amount of gear they were fishing before that. So that regulation has been completely counterproductive. I've made that remark to several people on several occasions, and it's all lost as anecdotal evidence. You heard all the evidence about agonism, and we've known that for years. Those of us that crabbed in this proposed closed sanctuary area in the ocean, we don't have any dissolved oxygen problems in the ocean. We don't have any industrial waste problems in the ocean. Our dead loss, crabbing in the ocean, as soon as crabs get down there, and we would start as soon as they would show up, sometime in June, sometimes a little later, is 75%. We would crab early in the morning when we used to be allowed. Now you're not allowed to crab early in the morning with a full awning on the boat, with the deck hose in every barrel all day long, trying to keep those crabs alive, and we'd finally get them to the dock and get them to the picking house or wherever, more than half of them would be dead. Good friend of mine had a crab house at Lynn Haven back in the 70s, and he crabbed mostly in the ocean all summer long, and he sold his crabs retail. They would come in. They didn't go very far. They came right to the dock. The crabs went right in the cooler right there at the foot of the Lynn Haven Bridge. The first thing he had was his boys go through the crabs, call out all the dead ones, immediately cook them. They'd wait a couple hours, and this proves what Rom said. Go back, go through them again. Get all the dead ones out and immediately cook them. You'd have to do that about 3 times until you got down to your basic survivors that might last till the following morning so that you'd have live crabs for your customers until the boat came back in. This is a fact. It's not something that you can compromise on. Those crabs are going to die. That's a fact. It's not conjecture. We've seen it. Day in and day out, we have to deal with it, and we worked around it, and we figured out how to not have the crabs spoil. Cook them immediately, go through them again, cook those, and then after a while, you'd have some basic survivors. the percentage was very low. As someone who has to deal with this subjective color chart on a daily basis, it's a real problem. It would be better if you just said, you can't take any sponge crafts. The thing that I want to know is how much or how many, what percentage is really necessary to protect of this female crab population. You know, you can protect all of it, just make them all illegal. If you want to protect 100%, protect 100%. And just go ahead and tell us. On these colors, if you're not very careful and you don't throw everything away that's not orange or yellow, those couple of colors, if you notice on that chart, are very close. You better hope your patrol officer is not colorblind a little bit. I have a good friend that fishes with me all the time. He paints his buoys black and white because that's all he can see, his black and white, you know. And there's some of us out there like that. You know, somebody might think a color is a lot brighter than it really is. If you don't believe it, go to Home Depot with your wife to pick out a color for your living room, especially when it's beige or gold or something like that. And that's exactly what we're faced with every day. The other thing that I've heard on a number of occasions, and I made this statement to Commissioner Bowman yesterday, just in casual conversation with patrol officers around the dock, and these are folks that we get along with just fine, have made the comments to me and other folks that they can't understand why Virginia allows the taking of sponge crabs. They think that's bad. Now, if I have to deal with a patrol officer who automatically believes that I shouldn't be catching sponge crabs, and he comes on my boat and he knows there's this regulation about colors, can I reasonably expect him to make an unbiased, unprejudicial judgment about those couple of colors in there? I know of instances where on a small number of crabs that has taken patrol officers anywhere from an hour and a half to almost 2 hours to cull a couple baskets of crabs to give someone a ticket. Now, we're on an eight-hour day. We have to quit in 8 hours. We can't start very early anymore when it's cool. You're almost defeated there then. Then if you're held up for a couple hours, even if you're sighted or not sighted, you've still lost a couple of hours. And your catch suffers. You might have been able to get in a little earlier than that couple hours. We don't stay out anywhere near the time limit. You know, the time limit is till 2. We're usually done by 11. So that puts us after lunchtime, just making up for those 2 hours so that we can get a day's work in. These are the problems that I have to deal with every day, and from what I can tell, to no particular benefit. Closing that sanctuary in the ocean will add how many square miles?
94.
We're up to over 1,000 square miles. The whole state of Virginia only has 42,000 square miles in it. We have a crab sanctuary that's 2% of the state's total entire area. How much do we really need? The other thing is this is not a complete bay-wide problem, as some of you would perceive. Most of the problem is in the lower bay, Pocosin Flats, Buckrow Beach, Hampton Roads. The crabbers down at my end of the world, we're the ones that are impacted most by this. Do you think the handful of us down there, by throwing back black sponges, that a high percentage of them are going to die anyway, are really doing irreparable harm to the fishery? My other concern with this is that with the increase in the sanctuary area and the de facto idea that some people just get fed up with this and move, some of them do, some of them don't, it's put excess pressure upriver. We already have a fragile area upriver because of the number of year-round peeler crabbers, people that are trying to catch high-value, high-quality male crabs. And now you've shoved the rest of these folks out of their normal crabbing areas over the last 2 or 3 years, and they're all shoved upriver. And since then, 1993, when the peeler fishery expanded, that's when that decline started going down. Which is more beneficial, getting folks out of those upriver areas and allowing them to work on something in Hampton Roads or just outside Hampton Roads where the sanctuary's still open, or shoving everybody right up the rivers and exacerbating a problem you have up there that may be even more harmful to this. Those are my main problems with this black sponge law. I don't think it's been effective, and I think it's put too much pressure further up the rivers. I think we have plenty of sanctuary. I got in hot water with crabbers in my area for suggesting that we go ahead and go along with this program to close the ocean. I've crabbed down there a number of years. I haven't been down there in a couple of years. The handful that crab down there now are really upset with me. And now we're going to give up that sanctuary and only get about 6 weeks out of the summer that we have to not deal with this black sponge crab issue. And I think the gain is going to be very negligible.
Thank you, Pete. Let me just make one comment as far as the law enforcement commenting about good or bad laws. It has always been my policy as chief of law enforcement that our officers, and I'll tell you, every one of them will tell you that knows, that we don't comment, and it's not appropriate to comment on whether a law is good, bad, or indifferent. We're responsible for enforcing the laws that are passed by the Commission and the General Assembly. Commenting on that, which may give the outward view that they are prejudiced and more likely to write versus considering giving a break or using some discretion is not part of our standard operating procedure. It never has been. So if you hear that again, I'd like to know the specific name of the person that made that comment. Not now if you've got it, but if you do, you can advise Colonel Rhodes or Colonel Lauderman, because that is certainly not standard operating procedure here.
Well, you know, I don't want you to take that the wrong way. That was in general conversation. And
you took it the wrong way if it was in general
conversation. No, I just took it as a piece of information and filed it in the back of my head.
Okay.
Whether they made the comment or not, their opinion is going to be the same. I would rather know what they think, and then I know what to expect.
Well, that's you. I'd rather not.
If somebody has a gun, I'd rather them have it on their hip than in their back of their belt. Okay. I know what to expect.
I just want to hammer home that officers are impartial.
No, these officers are good officers, and it wasn't taken the wrong way.
Okay, thank you. Who else had a comment? Mr. Powers. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Powers. I'm on the Blue Crab Committee. I voted in support of this measure, but of the black sponge crab lifting the ban and extending the area to what is de facto a closed area. One of the things that we did get in the committee was a staff report that clearly indicated that no one uses that area during the summer months when we're talking about it being closed. The issue I would like to talk about is a technical detail with the law. In the state code, it calls out the Lower Bay Sanctuary, which Rob pointed out, it's been in since 1942, is a commercial restriction. When this regulation was first written to include the deep water areas, there were two areas described. One was the one in code, and one was the newer area that's the deep water. The regulations only applied in the deep water area to both recreational and commercial,
right,
and the Lower Bay applied to commercial and recreational were allowed to crab there. This regulation is inconsistent with that. In addition to that, this regulation is inconsistent with another regulation that says the Lower Bay Sanctuary, as described in code, is open for recreational crabbing. I would ask that staff be directed to split the Blue Crab Sanctuary back to two areas and say one is for commercial only restrictions and the other is commercial and recreational restrictions.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Any further comment? The matter's before the commission for discussion. Rom, I appreciate the effort that you've provided to us. A lot of good data. Mm-hmm. Rob, good work. And Dr. McConaughey, I can see now why Governor Kane was so wise in placing you on the commission. Rob?
I don't have much to add. I think that Mr. Nixon had some good comments, but I also remember in 1996 that the commission met over at Warwick High School and had a monumental task to consider a lot of possible crab regulations. Industry was certainly pushing for some changes and concerned about the way things were going with the blue crab fisheries. And there was a subsequent meeting in February of that year before the regulations were set in place. So it took two meetings. Second meeting was here at the commission. And I don't know how much it was theoretical, but I think the idea of being risk-averse, which was not a term used in 1996, was really what the commission and industry both had in mind. They really didn't want measures that were crippling to the fishery, but they wanted measures that would promote benefits to the resource. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a great change in the spawning stock, and the fisheries as a result are at a low level, just as the spawning stock is. So I certainly think that even though it may not have taken scientific rigor to place the ban on the dark-colored sponge crab, in this day and age, since we have an analytical stock assessment, since we know where we stand on an exploitation rate, we know where we stand on the abundance of blue crabs, which have gone from about 800 million down to about 350 million, that we should have scientific rigor to take care of lifting the remaining portion of the dark-colored sponge crab ban, but that staff would support on page 2 of 5 of the regulation pertaining to the culling of crabs, if there could be language that would read either from March 17th through July 15th in paragraph D, which is stricken out now, to unstrike that paragraph and the other paragraphs pertaining to sponge crabs, and establish that from March 17th through July 15th, it shall be unlawful for any person to possess for a period longer than is necessary for immediate determination of the presence of dark egg mass more than 10 dark sponge crabs per United States bushel or 35 dark sponge crabs per barrel. So it could be that language or just simply until July 16th. But that's what staff would propose, and we certainly do support, as do most, I think, the addition to the sanctuary.
All right, you've heard staff recommendation. The matter's before the commission. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on Rob's comments, I too appreciate the comments that Pete Nixon brought before us today. He pointed out the fact that we really do have some problems in the fishery, and despite our best efforts to address them, some of them continue today. And I think the as we look back at the black sponge regulation as history and effectiveness, we see a regulation that started out with very good intent. As Rob said, it was designed to be risk-averse. And it does make, on paper, good sense, in theory, to protect crabs that are in a late stage of pregnancy that would be, theoretically at least, of maximum biological value of the stock. However, given the data that we've seen that Rom has produced, it does appear that based on the handling mortalities or high rates of post-release mortalities, that the resources essentially, or that the dark sponge crabs that are released from the pots are essentially lost not only to the resource but also to the fishery. However, I think you've also done a good job of framing the context that we're in. We're in a very difficult context. We're in a context where the resource is not doing well. For the past 10 out of the last 11 years, abundance has been below long-term averages. So we have to be conservative. And I think there are two ways to approach this. We can either, or several ways, we could repeal the regulation outright, but I think the more conservative approach would be to do it on a seasonal basis, as has been discussed. Not only do we have evidence that post-release mortality is high during that period, that is late in the season. We also have some evidence, as Dr. McConaughey suggested, that the egg mass qualities are higher earlier in the season. They're laying generally larger broods, and they're of the highest quality earlier in the season. And so right now our protection ought to be focused there on the first half of the season. But I think it would be appropriate to move forward with a repeal of the ban that would lift it from July 15th through September 15th, together with an adoption that the
the sanctuary off Virginia Beach be implemented.
Is that a form of a motion?
I'll offer that as a motion, Mr. Chairman. The sanctuary, though, to take effect for the whole period, the whole season, and not just the second half of the season.
Motion made by Mr. Robbins. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Who's that? Dr. McConaughey. Excuse me. Seconded by Dr. McConaughey. Further discussion? Mr. Bowden.
I know exactly how Pete feels on a lot of this stuff. When you have closed season, closed areas, it impacts some individuals much more than it does others. And this is clearly a case of that. And ordinarily, there's no way I could, you know, vote for something without having a strong relationship to the benefit. But in a case like this, I also realize that if we want one thing that may help the crabber by repealing part of the sponge crab, the only way I feel like it'll get through this commission is with the sanctuary part too. I don't think you can actually have one or the other. So I will be supporting the motion for that reason.
Thank you, Mr. Bowden. Further discussion? Mr. Schick and then Mr. Fox.
I do want to see the issue of upstream and up bay areas pressure increasing, the soak time of crab pots. These types of things are causing a lot of mortality in a higher stress area on the crabs and other areas. And I think that ongoing study will definitely show some of this, and hopefully we can look at those issues too, because we have seen a decline in the population, and I think that we need to look at those issues too. So this is a one step, and I think more steps that, of course, that we'll be taking. So I do support the first step in this.
Thank you, Mr. Fox.
I'm going to support the motion. I am swayed by a lot of the information here, one piece of data that was very important to me is that the crabbers don't seem to fish where they will catch a lot of sponge crabs, because then they have to go through the exercise of sorting them out. And I think to totally remove the prohibition would allow them to fish in places that are protected. They're not sanctuaries, but they are virtual sanctuaries by virtue of that. And it would, I've got to be confident that the mortality is lower in a crab that hadn't been caught than a crab that has been caught. And so I think that's a positive thing. And taking the prohibition off for the whole year, I think would be not be wise. I am terribly disturbed by the data on page 5 that show the decline in total harvest over the time period here. And I have a high regard for Mr. Nixon, and I'm saying this in jest, but I should say that the decline coincides almost exactly with his term of office on the Blue Crab Management Committee.
He's a good crabber.
But I think that's a piece of data that's irrelevant.
Dr. McConaughey?
I just want to make a comment. I respect Pete Nixon and all of the watermen. I think they have a lot of knowledge. At this point, we're just not sure, and I think it's probably prudent to be cautious on this at this point in time. But also, I think we need to really go back and look at a comprehensive examination of how we're regulating the fishery, and because it has not responded in the last 10 years. So I think Pete's comment that maybe we've missed something is something that we should look at.
Can I make one comment with Chris? During my time on that committee, on most issues I've been completely ignored.
Well, to close before we vote, what...
Just had a question concerning what Mr. Robbins indicated on the time period through September 15th. Would it be acceptable to realize that since Dr. McConaughey has said that is the last time of any kind of egg bearing, that the regulation wouldn't need to read through September 15th on that lifting?
That it would go through the rest of the year?
Yes.
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
What I'm most impressed about through the whole process is we've taken an examination, thorough examination of the regulation, how it's worked, and nothing bothers me anymore, Pete, in all due respect, than regulations that do no good. And this is a situation where we've had significant study, thought, and we will continue to have study and thought on the value of the regulation. So I guess coming back from my old days in law enforcement, I never liked laws that were there just because they were there. And for us as a commission to examine one now that may reduce the burden on some fishermen, I think, while still accomplishing what we're setting out to do, is a credit to those involved in the process. With that, the matter is before the commission for the vote. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. We have a few items left on the agenda, to say the least. We have an individual here that wears two hats. He works as a diligent and dedicated state employee, and he also is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates that needs to provide us some information, and he has a conflict. So what I would like to do with the commission's diligence is move item 27 up to the next item after we hear from Mr. Robbins, who has one comment he would like to make.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the benefit of the commission and the public, earlier this week I submitted a written request to Commissioner Bowman, and I think this is a timely point to discuss it, but we've just had a rather vigorous discussion on some of the complexities in the management of the blue crab resource, and I think we're at a point in our history that's fairly critical. We're dealing with a resource that's not responding very well to management. I think it's clear that at this point it would be appropriate to initiate a review of our management of that resource. For 10 of the last 11 years, the abundance has been below long-term averages. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just read this letter into the record.
Sure.
The Chesapeake Bay Commission's 2006 blue crab status report raises substantial concerns regarding the status of the baywide blue crab population. For nearly a decade, the blue crab population has been at a relatively low level of abundance, and in recent years, the population has not cycled as it did in the past. The past decade has also seen the implementation of significant regulatory changes by the VMRC, including an 8-hour workday, sanctuary expansions, and other regulatory modifications. In addition to fishing pressure, the blue crab population has been subjected to adverse environmental conditions, including large areas within the bay with low levels of dissolved oxygen, catastrophic eelgrass losses in 2005, and possible stresses associated with the recovered striped bass population. Despite the extensive regulation of this fishery, in 7 of the past 8 years, harvest pressure, as measured by the exploitation fraction, was above the target rate that